Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good. Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your black pants party.
And Jake Latondras.
And bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line Podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. And you know, it is Thursday. Joining me on the other end of the line, I always get that mumble jumbled up, Ramsey. Ramsey Russell.
What are you doing, Rocky? Man, look, if life was any better, I would already have my teeth sunk into this 3/4-pound bacon tomato lettuce sandwich I'm fixing to eat. And, I love a BLT. I'm tell you what, I love BLT. And I don't like a bacon-flavored BLT. I like a bacon BLT. If it ain't got a half pound worth of bacon on it, it ain't a sandwich. I'm sitting here. Mama just pulled the bacon out of the oven, and I'm already drooling. We got to be quick.
you can keep the lettuce off of it. I'm just a bacon tomato guy.
Man, but I know.
There's one very specific thing that I will not sway from. Nobody. I'll drive to the store if it's not in somebody's refrigerator. Only kind of mayonnaise I'll eat is blue plate.
No, that's where you're messing up, man. No, I won't touch blue. I would eat a tomato and bacon sandwich without mayonnaise before I ate blue plate. And I ain't dissing you. Everybody gets got their own flavor, but you got to try Duke's mayo. Duke mayonnaise is the only mayonnaise. And I'm bad about I got my own jar in the refrigerator because I'll sit there. I'll be making a sandwich and just eat a tablespoon of it. It's so good. Duke's
Ramsey,
mayonnaise.
You were cursed from this point on.
No.
There's some people cussing
you
right
me?
Now.
I don't care. That's because they ain't never had real mayonnaise. That's like saying, oh, I'll only eat a McDonald's hamburger. Well, folks, McDonald's ain't a hamburger. I don't know what it is, but it ain't a hamburger. And blue plate ain't mayonnaise. You know, that's just white stuff in a jar. Man, you want real mayonnaise. See, I tell you why I like Duke's. My grandmother, Russell, to my knowledge, and she died when I was probably about 16, 17 years old. To my knowledge, that woman couldn't cook but one thing. That was mayonnaise. She made from scratch homemade mayonnaise that was to die.
Really?
And then she would do something like she would make it real thin with lemon juice and use it as salad dressing. And a very simple salad. It's all I ever ate. I mean, but she made mayonnaise, and then she'd take that mayonnaise and make like a dressing. It was unbelievable. And Duke's tastes like her homemade mayonnaise. I mean, it is just the boiled down simple of whatever eggs and oil and whatever else you put in mayonnaise. It is fine. It is real mayonnaise.
And what about
ketchup? I'll eat gobs and gobs of it. Ketchup. I like a lot of different ketchups. I'm really not brand loyal on ketchup. I do eat Heinz, and some of these restaurants. I don't like a real that old cheap man ketchup. But I like Heinz better than Hunt's. Anita bought a pure ketchup that didn't have corn syrup or something in it. I think it's Heinz also, and it is really good, but it's tangy.
That's
still salty.
Man.
I'm not a ketchup purist. I like good ketchup, good tangy, spicy ketchup. You know, and I mean,
you brought. Let's say this: you brought a box of ketchup with every brand there is, and set it on the table and said, "All right, Rocky, you got to pick out your favorite ketchup." I don't know what it is. Heinz in a plastic bottle. Okay. You put Heinz in a glass bottle. You remember the ones that used to sit on the.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. You go into a diner. That ketchup, for some reason, tastes different than any other ketchup in the world.
Well, it's just like those little. That's just like those little 6 ounce old timey Coca Colas in a bottle. They tasted better than the tall bottled Cokes. And, you know, I've always marveled at Coca-Cola because, you know, back in when I was in college, it was just sheer marketing deception on the American public because they decided they could make a whole lot more money putting corn syrup in a Coca-Cola than sugar. But they didn't come out. They knew if they changed anything, America was going to revolt.
Whew.
So what they did is they just took Coca-Cola off the shelf and come out with New Coke. And it was horrible. It was terrible. And the expected reaction, America absolutely revolted. I mean, it pre-social media, but man, I mean, you thought it was a meltdown. You know, everybody hated Coke. They were selling off their personal stock they'd had for generations and everything else. And then Coca-Cola said, okay, we're going to come back out with the real thing. And they put them red label bottles back on the shelves, but it was different. And it had corn syrup instead of sugar. And it's still good, don't get me wrong. But, man, let me tell you what, everywhere else in the world that I go, from Azerbaijan, Mexico, Argentina, South Africa, everybody put sugar in Coca-Cola. And that is just like that Coca-Cola was meant to be, with cane sugar. But I don't know why it was back in those old days. My grandmother, same grandmother that made mayonnaise, would buy, she liked those little 6 ounce Coca-Colas. She'd never buy the big tall glass. She'd buy the little short bottles, and they were always so much better than the big bottles. The same thing, but they were different.
Oh man, I remember when Mountain Dew came in that little 6 ounce bottle back in the '80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a Mountain Dew fan, but that Mountain Dew that used to come in that little 6 ounce pony bottle, oh man, it was unreal. Unbelievable. Hey, let me ask you this question. I want to ask you something. Now, we get away from this food and choice stuff. But, all right, let's say you've been in prison for 10 years. Man, once a day they brought you a bottle of water. You got thirsty. The day you get out of prison, outside of the prison doors, hey, you're a thirsty guy. There on the table is a bottle of water or a Pepsi. Which one would you pick up and drink?
Pepsi.
Would you really?
Yeah, I drink Pepsi. Pepsi's not, it's not Coca-Cola, but it ain't bad.
You're a world traveler. I mean, I can see you drinking Pepsi.
Yeah. The truth of the matter is, God's honest truth, I don't drink soft drinks much anymore. I mean, hardly ever. Hardly ever do I drink a soft drink. I don't eat McDonald's. I don't eat fast food, but I don't drink soft drinks. I might drink a few times a year, drink Diet Coke. That's it. I really don't drink much soft drinks at all. So yeah, but if I'd been drinking water in jail for like Papillon for 10 years, I'm sure I'd go and get me just something different for a change. I'd drink Pepsi.
There's some places in the world you're not going to find a Coke. The only thing they have is Pepsi.
Yeah,
but you put any, that's the thing that bothers me. You let any red-blooded American walk into a store and pick a Pepsi over a Coke? Something's wrong with that guy.
They're probably from the north. I hate to say it, but they're probably from the north. Man, Coca-Cola is as southern as it gets, and I just can't imagine somebody choosing any. You know, and I like RC Cola once in a freaking blue moon, but not really. I mean, I probably hadn't drank one since high school. Why? When you can go get a Coca-Cola. You know, my wife, she cuts back on that kind of stuff. She for some reason, but you know, just for, like, you know, some guys might bring home flowers for their wife. You know what I bring home? There's a quick stop down the road that sells old bottled Coca-Colas, but they got a little white label on because they come out of Mexico and they got real sugar. It tastes just like those Coca-Colas back in the 70s. And that's what I'll buy her, just because she says she ain't going to drink it, but she does. I'll put three or four of them in the refrigerator, and they're gone in a few days. She loves Coca-Cola. But y'all need to try that Duke's mayonnaise. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, you need to try Duke's mayonnaise. I just ain't believing you choose Blue Plate over Duke. That just ain't no way. Now, I can see you swigging it down with Pepsi-Cola or something, but not on a fair
Oh, get out of here. The only people that drink Pepsi are liberals, foreigners, or soccer players.
I don't see. I really don't see Pepsi. I'm just trying to think of any country I've been in and walked into a store, because that is one cool thing I like to do. If I'm in a new country, it's kind of cool going into their grocery stores and walking around, you know, and just walk the aisles and see. You can tell a lot about people, you know, by just seeing. Walking in a grocery store and checking it out, you know.
Chinese and Mexicans love Pepsi.
I can see that. But boy, I see Coca-Cola everywhere. They are a dominant market force. They Coca-Cola is everywhere. And I mean everywhere. The real thing.
See, like I said, I don't have a problem with foreigners as much as I do soccer lovers and soccer players and liberals.
Where you would struggle, getting back on them condiments, where you would struggle is in foreign countries with things like ketchup or you know, Argentina. Shoot, man, you might as well skip. I don't know what it is, but it ain't ketchup.
What about pancake syrup?
You ask me what kind I like?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really and truly, you know, as little as I eat it, I'm going to go for the real maple syrup. Just a real in a metal can maple syrup, and if I don't eat that, I want it to have that maple flavor.
I am a Blackburn.
I know you're gonna say that. That's good on good buttered biscuits. You know you can't beat Blackburn. And I've got a friend from Georgia that every year sends me just. He'll I don't even talk to him all year, and he'll just send me a text. I got something coming to you, and I know what it's going to be. He makes sorghum molasses. Now that little tin of sorghum molasses he sends every year, he'll send some homemade pepper sauce and different stuff. But that homemade tin of molasses is fine. I don't eat a lot of biscuit stuff too much, but. Oh, I tell you what, I don't make baked beans without putting brown sugar and good, dark, black molasses in it. That's going to happen. You know, now you can't make baked beans without that.
Hey, a lot of people have asked me about, we talked about John Taylor last week over MC, and a lot of people have asked me about that. Man, he had a rough weekend, but... doing a little bit better this week. I ask all the people that's listening to this, if you believe in prayer, please pray for our friend John Taylor. Great guy.
Yeah, please do.
Great human being.
Great guy. Great guy. You know,
great
I got one of our mutual friends, he and I, you know, is going to Argentina, leaving Sunday for Argentina, going to Rio Salado. John was supposed to be there, and he's like, man, I feel bad. Something could happen. I said, well, don't feel bad. I said, you know, if you hear the worst, let's pray we don't. But if you hear the worst, I mean, go out and spend time with the memory of John and shoot ducks like you know John would. You know what I'm saying? And I know there's nowhere John would rather be than down there shooting a bunch of ducks. He's a fine man and a fine duck hunter, and it's been heavy on my heart because he was such a good guy. And you know, he is a good guy. I hate to see him in this bind he's in. But you know, the man's got a, he's a fierce man, and he's hanging in there. By gosh, he's hanging in there. Sunday night he hit a rough patch, but he's still hanging in, and you know, he can still come out of it. You know.
Yeah. I've been texting back and forth with Hunter a lot, his son, and seems to be doing better, a little better this week. But he's a tough, gosh, dog, man, he's a tough old guy. He's not old like in the old age, but old, tough old guy. Great guy.
Yep, yes, he is. He sure is. And I, you know, so I appreciate everybody that believes in the power of prayer, saying one. You know, there's a lot to be said for the power of prayer.
All right,
but I've enjoyed listening to your guests. I tell you, you got so many good guests coming on your podcast now. I get a little wrapped up, and man, you know, Jeff's story is coming on. Between him and the Toast guy Ryan, it makes me feel paranoid about going out and doing this thing we like to do, duck hunting. You know, we do everything we can, and it's been a lot. I'm proud to see. I really am. I mean, think about it, Rocky. What you've done by bringing these podcasts on, there are discussions going on about this stuff now. I mean, there's threads about tagging and documenting the migratory bird preservation facility, and a lot of questions going on. Well, what do I do? And does that mean I need to do this? And you know, all you can do is, there's a lot of them laws. I mean, 50 CFR Part 20, read them and try to do your best. I know, you know, how many duck camps do you think there are, Rocky? The state of Mississippi and the country, how many duck camps you think there are that come in with straps of ducks and put them in a walk-in cooler, put them in a pile and walk off? Maybe even go home Sunday night, forget about them, leave them at camp for somebody else to deal with. I dealt with that. I was Jesus in the temple one time at a camp meeting because I was there by myself. And my strap has my name on it, to which I add a tag when I come in, because I don't clean my ducks every morning. I just, you know, get a couple of days worth of ducks. And you know, if the guy does shoot a mallard or two and doesn't want to fool with them, I'll take them. And then when I clean them. But I walked down to the cooler one day, and there was my strap hanging up, and there was five other straps. There were just hanging. Lanyards full of ducks hanging without a name, without nothing. There wasn't a soul at that camp but old Double R. And I don't know, them ducks disappeared. My ducks stayed. Them ducks disappeared. And next weekend, somebody said something about it. I said, "You better tag him, Bird." And it became a Jesus in the temple moment at a camp meeting. You know, those ducks are your responsibility. Because woe be unto the poor soul sitting there minding his own business one Sunday evening. Somebody rolls in to check. You sitting there stuck with, you know, 5-10 limits of ducks. Possession's 9/10 of the law. Whose are they if they ain't tagged? I get, you know, I would be furious if something like that happened to me. You know, but it's a pass through discussion. This stuff is serious, and these guys who are in charge of enforcing these laws are taking it very serious. You know, it's scary to me. You know, but we owe it. Don't you think, Rocky, we owe it to ourselves and to hunting and to the resource to do our best? And I've seen since we've been doing Get Ducks, I've seen what I perceive to be a shift in the modern hunter. Not speaking for everybody, because that's not the truth. There's exceptions. But I can remember 15 years ago when people would call and ask about Argentina, first question, how many ducks am I going to kill? And man, that question may not even come up these days, because it's more about the hunt and the whole element of the hunt than just trigger pulling. But I was reminded listening to a podcast. I was just listening to it out of mind the other day, listening to Jeff, listening to Ryan talk. And I got to listening to my buddy Rob Heflin talk, and I literally bust out laughing when the Spoonies made me do it. When he said, "Well, the Spoonies made me do it," but it just made me think, you know, the whole nature of that conversation. You know, we were all young one time, ignorant, but I did remember a Bible verse from 1 Corinthians that said something of the nature. You know, when we're children, we talk like children, we act like children. But when we grow up, we act like men. And men are responsible. And you know, what I would tell anybody, whether you listen to those podcasts or not, listen to them. But you know, this is serious business nowadays. A man went into jail for migratory bird violations, let alone money, let alone not getting to hunt. If going out and hunting and taking the good and the bad and the ugly, the great days when you shoot 6 ducks and the bad days when you scratch, and the middle between days, which is most days when you shoot somewhere between scratch and a limit, enjoy those days. Enjoy them for what they are. And if there's something about you that you just can't hardly stand it, you just got to shoot all you can see. Call me up and let's go to Argentina. I'll wear you out shooting ducks down there. You'll get your feel. But you really got to think about it. I can tell you what, for what you're going to deal with being careless and not respecting that law that is there to protect the resource, what you liable to pay and do without, you could have gone to Argentina. You know, I don't – and we've all been young before. We've all been young and carefree and willful of the law and of limits. We've all been there. I don't believe anybody. I don't believe anybody grew up dove hunting in Mississippi and didn't shoot a few extra when they could. You know, but then you grew up and realized, oh, you know, I'm not supposed to. There's consequences. You know, we were all young and dumb. Might touch a hot stove one day, but you realize, oh yeah, there's consequences. I don't do that stuff. You know, and but I really enjoyed listening to Rob. I'm proud you brought him on. I know there's some folks out there don't like Rob because he's a game warden, and I do believe the man would have written his mama a ticket. I do.
Ooh,
believe
a lot
that.
Of convincing.
Yeah, there. I believe that, but I'm glad you got it on, because Rob, besides being a game warden and being knowledgeable, or I guess he's an ex game warden now, but being knowledgeable of a lot of the topic matter, a lot of these questions that are being asked. And how things are processed, what goes on. Who doesn't like an old game warden story? But Rob's a storyteller. Man, he's a good storyteller. In fact, Rocky, did you know this the first time, way back when now, but it wasn't like back in the dark ages, but the first time I ever saw my name in GetDucks.com in print was a story that Rob wrote back in 2009. And he what was the name? Mississippi Game and Fish or Mississippi Wild. It was one of these outdoor publications. And Rob wrote a story about snipe hunting. And I had sent him, he had somehow on an OMS Duck chat room become aware that I snipe hunted with decoys. And it reached out to me and asked me that I send him a couple of samples to look at. And Rob, if you're listening, you know, send them back. I can wait, but I'd like to get them back one day. And I had made a 5-gallon bucket full of snipe silhouettes, and they work. Boy, they work. They really work good. They're oversized. They're fairly big compared to a real snipe. And I put them on long dowels. Some of them maybe 8-10 inches tall off the mud flap. That way you can stick them in the mud a little bit. If you're hunting cut rice or a lot of stubble or something like that, the birds will get up above that cover where the snipe can see them. And if you find a feeding area for Wilson's snipe, I recommend not trying to catch them in a bag. It don't work. But you can go out there and bust them out by walking up in there and set your decoys out, and they'll come in. Oh, they're going to come in. And it's very, very sporting as compared to a duck or a pigeon or anything else you might decoy, because they come in at a real steep angle real fast into those decoys. And you got to have some bird ID about you, because everything will decoy to those snipe decoy, yellow legs and dowitchers, everything will come decoying to them. So you got to pay attention that it's snipey shooting. But they're delicious. They're smaller than a dove, but they're very, very good to eat like a dove. They got a lot of fat, and they're very, very good to eat. And Rob had written that story. I went back and read it after listening to his podcast the other day. And that was the first time, but he's a very, very good storyteller. And who knows what all he's seen. I really enjoyed that story about him catching those guys the other day, and then blaming it on the spoonies. The spoonies made us do it. And I really enjoyed that. And I'll tell you this own story. Rob would write his, I'm convinced he would buy the book now. Back in the days, since that story was written, so it wasn't too terribly long ago, but it was a good way back. I loved a dove hunt. Love it. Goes back that time I got hurt and didn't dove hunt. It's the first time I could remember. So I'd always dove hunt open day. And it's a family tradition for my family. We love to dove hunt. We're gonna get together, hell of high water, and we're gonna go dove hunt Labor Day weekend or so. And you know, got enough friends and usually get some good invites. And I've been invited to the field up in the Delta. One of the best dove fields I'd ever hunted. I mean, bar none. One of them. It's just the geographic location of that field was really good. Really good hunting rock in. But I had just gotten back from Argentina, where it's winter time, and I was struggling with that heat, man. I mean, I was probably fat and out of shape too, but I was struggling with that heat. And I was glad to have knocked out my limit, or nearly my limit, and I decided I'm going to truck with my daughter and gonna sit up in the air conditioning and let Forrest and Duncan finish up getting their limit. And they each had a 12 gauge. They bought themselves Benelli. Took my 12 gauge back to the truck, and I'd brought a little 20 gauge for Parker. He hadn't been shot in forever. A little Benelli 20 gauge, and carelessly, I didn't check it for a plug. But why would I check it for a plug? You know. Well, apparently, the boys knew how to took a plug out for squirrel hunting or something, and didn't put it back in, and I didn't check it. So there, I'd been sitting with her. She didn't shoot, but it didn't matter with an unplugged gun because I didn't check it. And both the boys still love that gun. They grew up shooting that gun. So when I walked the truck, they decided one of them wanted to shoot it. I was sitting there in the air conditioning, starting to cool off, when an ATV come up and some law enforcement, state law enforcement, very nice people. They really were nice and professional people. They were good folks, and they started checking, and I didn't have nothing to be worried about, so I was just sitting there, just in air condition, minding my own business, watching them check folks and watching folks stop shooting and all that good stuff. Well, Duncan had been holding the unplugged gun at the time, and one of the game boards come and got me, and we were talking, and he was upset, and he was talking about this unplugged gun. Well, Duncan was 11 years old. Let's say, I guess he was 11. So I might have to give this boy a ticket. I said, no, sir. You and I both know you can't give an 11-year-old a ticket. You're going to give it to his daddy, and I'm his daddy. It's my fault that he's shooting an unplugged gun. He don't know any better. I ain't going to lie to you. I was polite as I could be. Because, this man just doing his job. But I'm not lying when I say I could hear my heart beating through my lungs. My heart was tacking hard because of the heat. And, I said, look, if you're going to give me a ticket, give me a ticket. Let's get this show on the road, because if we sit here and deliberate very long, I'm probably going to fall out and have a heat stroke. And he didn't know what to think when I said that. And his partner come by. His partner had checked me there at the truck, checked all the guns in the truck, and seen they were plugged. And said, hey, that's fine. I checked that man's guns. He knows the gun's supposed to be plugged. That little boy's shooting it, so just let him be. But what the issue was while we were having a discussion is not too far away was a 5-gallon bucket spilling over the top with doves. One of my doves, I can tell you that, and one of my kids' doves. But it was somebody's doves. Nobody was on the dove. Nobody was within 50 feet of them doves. I can tell you, there wasn't nobody within 50 feet of a 5-gallon bucket full of doves sitting out there as a seat. And there was one of the other hunters on the field was being rancorous. I mean, downright rude to the game wardens who were just out there doing their jobs. And they said, "Whose bucket is that?" Doug. I said, "I have no idea. I've been sitting over in the shade of my truck, but it's not my kids, because they're way over there where you stopped them. And it's not mine." They said, "Well, who is that guy right there?" I said, "I have no idea." I mean, Rocky, far, I would have guessed on this field. As far as I know, that guy could have been the lieutenant governor's son. Who knows? I don't know who these people are. But I didn't know who Dove they were, so I just politely told the guy, I said, I don't know who Dove they are, but they're not mine, and they're not my boys. You agree with that? He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I don't know who they are, and I'm a guest on this field. I don't know who those people are, so it could be anybody." He understood that, and he let me go. And as I was leaving, I saw Rob Heflin. I was surprised he went on the field. He was out there talking to somebody on the road. And I waved to him and drove on back to camp. I made up my mind. I said, "You know, Ramsey, what if that field had been baited? I wouldn't have known. I mean, really, you think about it, man. You're getting bodied. Hey, come over dove hunt. You don't know." And I just, you know, with that little issue right there, I was getting ducks and things were cooking. And I said, you know, last thing, I mean, here I am, getducks.com, and didn't think to check a child's plug shotgun. That's bad enough. Rock, it'd been embarrassing. It'd be just downright embarrassing to get a ticket over something like that. Fine, it'll take care of itself. It'd been embarrassing. It'd been humiliating to have gotten a ticket. And, you know, I've known Rob a long time. You know, back in the old MS Ducks day, Rob, before he was a game warden, he did dove hunts. He one time he invited a bunch of us off the board to come kill hunting with him. And took my kids. They were babies, man. I mean, they need to kind of like be walked, carried in. You could pick them up and carry them into where we were going hunting. They were babies. And we all kind of knew each other in that environment. And I remember Rob had a pay field, and, you know, growing sunflowers is an expensive proposition, especially if you're me and not a farmer. I called Rob that next season and said, "You got room in your field?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "All right." I sent him a check. "I'm going to hunt with Rob. I bet you Rob's field's legal." And he had a little old field up there around Bell's on it. And I hunted with him, I guess, 3 years after that. Till he got out of it. And, you know, it's getting back to Rob being by the book. And first time I went up there, I got there a little late, didn't know where to get, and we shot. It was just me and Parker. We shot most of a limit. And four-year-old calf rope, I think I left one bird shy. I was on the wrong side of the field, but still, it was a good dove hunt. Next time we went, I had my boys with me. And I knew better yet where to go. I had a great idea where to go in that field, having hunted there, you know, several times over the season. And got in there, had two spots in the field. Me and my daughter, if she went, my boys. That's fine. We'll share two spots. So we booked out through that field and got started, and it was good. Oh, we was in the right spot that day. And man, he did really, really nice sunflower fields, and he knew how to spray them just right, and he would disc them just right. So you had some sunflowers, you had some open areas. It was really, and you had some water back around you on both sides of the field. So it was just a nice little field. And you know, one thing I enjoyed about hunting that field is, you know, you sit out there on the gravel road for the hunt or after the hunt and just talk to folks. I like the people that were members or that were have been hunting for years with him. I like the people. A lot of them were just, a lot of them didn't hunt nothing but doves, and they were just a pleasure to talk to. You know, they were good guys. They really. I never remember an instance of somebody shooting at a low bird. You know, they just got out there and behaved and had a good time. Except one time, there was a guy. Rob sent out an email and said, "Do not take to the field. I'm tired of arguing with people trying to cheat and do this and do that. So the stakes are staked out, and do not go to the field until whatever time, 1 o'clock. I don't remember what time it was. 1 o'clock, whatever." And so we were all sitting there BSing and talking and getting our stuff together, you know, and watching our watches, you know. We're all behaving. Man says, "Huntsville at 1 o'clock is when we'll go, 1 o'clock. And bing, bang, 1 o'clock came, and me and the boy grabbed our bucks, and we knew just where we were heading, only shade in the field. And halfway to it, here come some guys from the back end on ATVs, and their buckets were already out, which means they'd been there before to shoot, you know, the dart time. Well, here they come to go get with their buckets. I get mad. I'm like, they cheated, them cheaters. It didn't matter. By the time I got down to where they were, Rob done come up behind them too and said, y'all, I said 1 o'clock start time. Y'all pack your stuff up. When everybody else picks a spot, y'all, then y'all can go get your plot and field. He was that kind of fair guy. He said 1 o'clock, and there ain't going to be no cheat.
That one always time been that way.
He's always been that way. I mean, you know, but you know, it kept harmony. It kept peace. Rob just, it was his field. He said, y'all take the field at 1 o'clock, and here come three or four guys cheating, sneaking in from the back way, going to lay their bucket out while we're all up on the road sweating and behaving. He put them to the back of the line, man. And that worked out great that year. But I never forget that second year we were hunting with him. Forrest and Duncan wanted to hunt together, so they were, I don't know how far those blinds were apart. He would tape little spots. I'm going to say 60 yards, give or take, you know, just real nice spaced out throughout the whole field. And I went and found one I liked, and they kept walking a little bit further back, and it was good. Oh, it was good, and it was steady. It was hotter than blue blazes. Rocky, I grew up hunting, you know, where you couldn't hunt in Mississippi for opening day of dove season until noon. That's when it started, and it was always hot. Even as a child, it was just scorching. Man, scorching. There ain't nowhere, I don't think, hotter than in the middle of a wheat field or a dove field on September 1st with the sun beating down on you. If there's anywhere hotter than that, I ain't set foot in it. And I'm really fond of these morning dove hunts. I will not lie to you. I like a morning dove hunt. And but anyway, we get out there and we start to shoot. And, you know, Rob would guaranteed Rob was going to check every hunter in that field, his field. He would be there just right after the shoot started, he'd start making rounds on foot. He'd walk down the field and back all them rows checking hunters. And I was proud, man. I heard old Rob down there talking to Forrest and Duncan, you know, they were laughing and cutting up. And I mean, my boys known him since they were babies. He'd known of them or known them. You know, when Forrest was 8 years old and got into taxidermy, Rob, he knew Forrest was practicing a lot on, and man, look, bluebills and ruddy ducks. They got skin thick as boot leather. They're good practice ducks. And Forrest was, boy, the number of ruddy ducks and scalp he mounted, learning how to mount ducks through our buddy Pat Pitt. And Rob called me or wrote me one day an email and said, "Hey, you know, got a bunch. I'm sure he got them in from game warden," and said, "You know, I'll hang on to them and send them to Forrest for practice birds if you like." I said, "Sure." Man, he sent a whole bunch of them, you know, and Forrest, by God, skinned them and fleshed them and mounted them for practice. So they knew each other. And man, they were laughing and cutting up and gee-hawing. All of a sudden, things got quiet. Anything done about it, you know. Forrest kind of shortly thereafter started walking my way with his head down. Figured maybe he done shot his limit. I was still one or two away. And he come up to me and said, "I got to go to the truck. Rob's mad." I go, "What?" He said, "Now I knew for a fact for a bona fide fact that I had put a plug in. I had checked and made sure every gun was plugged. Previous year or two, I'd gone to the field with another plug gun and got lucky. This year, I can tell you before we go dove hunt, we all check our plugs and show each other. And I don't know how the man put a fourth shell in that gun. But by God, it held a fourth shell. And the law don't say that you got to shoot doves and ducks with a plug gun. That ain't what the law says. It says with a gun incapable of holding more than three shots. Forrest came to me with his gun and said, "He got a fourth bullet in here, Daddy." I said, "The heck you say?" He said, "Uh-uh." He said to meet him at the truck. And I said, "Well, you better go meet him at the truck. I got one more dove to shoot." So Forrest took off back toward the truck. And Rob came to me and said, "Yeah, and he, let's go meet the truck, talk to his son." I said, "Rob, that gun was plugged." He said, "I know, but I got a bullet in Ramsey." He said, "Look, this is my field." And he said, "Ain't nobody gonna break the law on my field. I can't have it." And, you know, whew, boy, it's like walking to the principal's office after you done something, you know. Because not only was Rob law enforcement, and here I was with a gun somehow incapable of holding more than three shots or whatever, but I mean, I knew Rob. I was a tad ashamed. But I was sitting there wondering myself, how in the world did he get, I don't know how he got that shotgun shell in there, but I know I had to take the gun apart to get it out. But he got it in there. And, you know, we've sent SWAT plugs, and I can't get it in there, and Forrest can't get it in. We can't put a third shell, we can't get a fourth shell in them guns. Now, we SWAT plug. I don't know what it was about that particular plug, but he was able to slide one in that magazine. And, you know, Forrest was 15 years old, and Rob said, he said, "You're 15 years old. I could write you a ticket, but I'm not." He said, "You know the rules." He said, "Don't come to my field again. In fact, don't hunt again with a gun that'll hold a four shell no matter what." He said, "I'm going to give you a warning this time, because I was 15 one time myself." And see, that's his common sense. It's fair. Now, I bet if it'd been my gun, he tried to get a four shell of mine, it wouldn't fit. But if it'd been my gun, he'd rip me a ticket. And I deserved it. I thought that I always remembered him letting Forrest off the hook like that. I mean, you know, he took the opportunity to make an impression on him.
Teachable moment.
Instead of doing what he could, a teachable moment. And, you know, I'm sorry, but that's just as fair as it can be. You know, and, but you know, Rocky, for reasons in podcast have alluded to, for reasons that I did work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a forester back in the day. We'll talk about that one day, but. But, you know, he mentioned Mark Johnson, a federal agent that came after Pilgrim up there at Grenada. I knew those guys. I worked with them. They were in the office. I knew them. Rocky, I'd have been ashamed for my friend Mark Johnson, a federal agent, or for my friend Rob Heflin to show up and give me a ticket. I'd have been ashamed of it. I mean, you know, let alone have to pay a fine, have to forfeit something. I mean, that'd be terrible. But I would have been ashamed to have done that. It'd be like, I might as well come to your house and see $5 on the counter, put it in my pocket, and then get caught by you. I'd be that ashamed. You know, it's no sense in that kind of stuff. And but anyway, I'm really looking forward to Rob. Story, because he's going to have some good stories, I'm sure.
You bring up an interesting name, and as crazy as this sounds, guess who I'm eating lunch with tomorrow?
Who?
Mr. Pilgrim himself.
Holy cow. Man,
I'm going
to... Tell him I said hello, because I'm going to tell you. Pilgrim. I guarantee you that name still evokes fear and trembling up in North Delta, Mississippi. And I never heard of him. Man, I graduated Mississippi State University. I didn't hunt that part of the world. I didn't hunt the free state of Tallahatchie. I didn't hunt up there, you know. When I showed up at the office, I didn't know who he was. I never heard of him. Man, that's like old Rooster Cogburn of sheriffs. I mean, he was sent down to clean up the North Delta, Mississippi, and he did it. You know, he was the high sheriff. And I didn't know all that.
It's just like you say. You can say the name, and for a waterfowler, it's still your hair stands up.
Well, mine didn't because I was always kind of legal down there, you know. But as I lived in Grenada 3 years, and I did start hunting that part of the world, and I was active in Ducks Unlimited, and then the chapter president, and everybody had a Pilgreen story. Everybody. Every duck hunter had a Pilgreen story. And I got to hear, you know, because the walls were thin, I got to hear a lot of stuff in the office. And, Rocky, I'm telling you what, if you can ever get that man on your podcast, because, you know, and luckily for me, I did not have a problem with Pilgreen. I'd like I say, when he wasn't out doing special agent type stuff, I'd see him around the office sometimes, and he wasn't just always Mr. Conversationalist. Now I can tell you he wasn't a lot about small talk, but I did one time, several times, you know, we'd sit at the coffee table and talk and visit, and the man just he had seen so much. He'd seen some things. He'd seen some changes in the day. He'd seen some of those changes we talked about all the different changes on the landscape and how it affected ducks. He'd seen since he had showed up in North Delta. He'd seen a lot of profound changes. He'd seen the worst. You know, Pilgreen told me something one time, and I'm not trying to paint him into a corner or nothing else, but it made an impression on me, Rocky. It made an impression on me. Now, you hear the one side, and you see some of that stuff, you know, been talked about in these podcasts that make you scratch your head and say, you know what, I don't like it. You know, how am I supposed to respect that? But on the other hand, Pilgreen said something to me one time. And he said he just indicated he didn't like duck hunters. I don't like them. I ain't gonna say that's what he said verbatim. But he liked me. We were friends. We saw each other at the office. Had dinner at his house one time. Had a beautiful cabin. Had a great little boy. A beautiful wife. Good family. You know, I'm sitting here looking. I'm sitting in my den. I'm sitting here looking at one of the most famous, beautiful waterfowl prints. My favorite waterfowl print ever. It's a blue-winged teal pitching in over the bachelor, and there's an old paddle boat in the back with vines growing up over it. And I saw that in his office one day and fell in love with it. I said, my God, it's beautiful. I love blue-winged teal, and I just love that vibe, you know. And I saw Pilgreen a few weeks later. Said, here, I know that guy, and I got this picture for you. I'm sitting here looking at it. You know, got a gift from Pilgreen. And but he said he didn't like duck hunting. I said, why? He said, I never met one that didn't lie to me. I didn't think about that. Now he wasn't talking about, you know, he wasn't talking about going to church or sitting there in the government office or going over here, going over there, you know, just talking to folks like me and you, or you know, Pilgreen didn't just walk around checking licenses. You know, he was investigating through a spotting scope, through a binoculars, through whatever, however they do their magic. You know, he was doing a lot of looking. And what I learned from stories around town about Pilgreen from working in that in fishing, wildlife, and biome, what I learned is, let me tell you something, guys. If you're out there in the blind and a special agent walk up on you, you're caught. Lie, deny, whatever. But them extra ducks you done folded up or stomped down, they got you. They ain't gonna waste their time and tip their hand just coming out there to make pleasantries and check your license.
No, they're not there to check license
and they got
or ask about mom and them. They don't care
Ain't out there to talk about the weather. They've been watching for good reason, probably. They got you. I will forget here's my favorite Pilgrim story. Now, I ain't going to tell you my favorite Pilgrim story. Catfish Flaw told me that, and somebody, he can tell a lot better than I can. My favorite Pilgrim story I heard over dinner one time in Grenada, and some boys had been out hunting some timber or something out some standing trees. And they said it really wasn't a great day, a great hunt, whatever. You know, it was terrible hunting condition because it was so quiet and so cloudy, and the water was just slick like a mirror. And, you know, maybe some tupelos and cypress, stuff like that, and they'd been shooting some ducks and somehow ended up with an extra duck. And, you know, careless, not counting, whatever. And they said it was so quiet, so still, that when you were just leaned against the trees, you know, in between the volleys, everybody just being quiet and leaned up against the trees, you know, the water was just slick. You know, you said you could hear a deer walking 150 yards away. So they wrapped up their hunt and were heading back, you know, strapped up the birds, whatever, coming back. And the boy said he walked about 20 yards where he, you know, last stop was the tree he'd been leaning on. He got it by and got this and got that strapped up. And he turned the very next tree he come to, about 10, 15, 20 yards away, whatever. He said, Pilgrim stepped out and he said, I scream like a girl. He said, I'm just walking along my own business. And there's old Pilgrim just appears out of nowhere, steps out from behind a tree and says, howdy, boys. And he said, I ran in place and screamed. It scared me so bad. He said, and the whole time I'm thinking, how in the world did somebody walk up a mile, whatever, you know, into this spot where we were shooting undetected? Because we could, you know, it was impossible. It's like he just gravitated in there, walking on the water quietly. He said, how y'all doing? Y'all have a good hunt? Yeah, yeah. Y'all get any birds? Oh, yeah, we got a limit. He goes, y'all sure that's all you got? He goes, oh, yeah, of course. That's all we got. He said, you ain't got no more birds than just what's right here on the strap? He says, no. He said, you ain't got a hen sitting in a hollow tree 15 yards behind you? I'll look at you and go, go, I appreciate you going and getting it instead of me having to walk over there and get it. He knew it. He'd seen it. But, you know, I never forget him saying that. It's always made me cognizant. I mean, a man, you know, I guess Rocky, if he walks up on me on you know, because duck hunting's an imperfect sport. I do my very utmost best to recover my birds, to shoot my birds. Me and my boys, they're grown boys now. We really do, given the opportunity, take turns. I mean, my gosh, you know, what's the hurry to get back to camp? Ain't nothing to do in camp, you know, but sit around. So, yeah, man, you let those days hit where I love those days where Bar shoots his, I shoot mine, Duncan shoots his, Ian shoots his. I mean, you know, ain't no hurry. Pair comes in, you shoot the right, I shoot the left. But, you know, every once in a blue moon, Rocky, it's a game of errors. You know, Bluebill, we call them Bluebills, but Butterballs, daggum ringnecks. That's a bird. They're fast. They're balled up tight. It could happen that you go to shoot your sixth bird and two fall. It's happened. I know it happens. You know, it could happen that six mallards come in, you shoot the right, I shoot the left, boom, boom, we shoot a bird and 50 yards out there, one falls. He took a wild BB somewhere and they fall. Like, what you going to do, leave it? No, I'm not. I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to bring it in. And I guess if the man shows up, I might say, yeah, well, I'm a bird over. I ain't going to leave it. My granddaddy's upbringing won't let me do it. I don't go out there to intentionally shoot a bird over, but it could happen completely and utterly on accident. And I know it has happened before, and more than once, when those ring decks ball up, it can happen, you know. And that's a big difference going out and shooting 50 birds over the limit, you know.
Pilgreen's been retired, what, 12 years probably?
Oh, I bet longer than that, Rocky. I bet he's been retired 20 some odd years. He retired. Right, so. I was at Fish and Wildlife Service for 3 years, 3.5 years maybe. It's a long time ago. It don't seem like a long time ago. I went to work in Grenada Fish and Wildlife Service, North Mississippi Refuge Complex, as the forester in 1998. And I left. I remember letting my boss know that I had applied and was likely getting a job at U.S. Department of Agriculture on 9/11. And what was that, 2000 or 2001? I think it was 2001. And I left to report to that job in 2002, January 2002. That was the year my daughter was born. And as I recall, in fact, I know Mark Johnson had already started working there when I left. So, Pilgrim, I'm just going to venture a guess through the fog of time that Pilgreen retired in 99 or 2000. That's 20 years ago.
All right. So let me tell you a little backstory to this. And it's still not written in stone that he's going to be on the podcast, but I will say this. If he is, and he tells all the stories that he has, it's going to be the most legendary podcast in the outdoor world has ever been put together. Ever. I'll say that.
Ever. 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 Pilgreen, I'm telling you, in my lifetime, and I didn't know some of them old boys from back before them, but Pilgreen was probably the most fabled and legendary federal agent, certainly in the Deep South, certainly in the state of Mississippi. And,
Louisiana. He worked Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Mississippi.
Well, the federal agent, he worked everywhere, but his home office was there in Mississippi, and he was assigned to clean up the free state of Tallahatchie. And you know, just like Matt Dillon going to clean up Dodge City, that was Pilgreen's job, best I understand it. I think he did a pretty doggone good job. And I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find anybody at all back in those good old days that didn't have at least one really good, I almost said hilarious, Pilgreen story.
Oh,
and my favorite Pilgreen story that I am not going to tell, I'd butcher it, was him singing, him P-rowing into a duck hole up near in the Brazil Flyway singing Here Comes Santa Claus. That when Catfish Flaw told me that story, I literally cried laughing. And there's some people who can tell a story, and there's some people who can tell a story. Mr. Catfish Flock can flat out tell a story. And he knew that story, and he knew those guys involved, and it was just, that was my favorite Pilgreen story I ever heard.
I think that it's doing, I'm kind of like you. The federal agent has a job to do, and yeah, we may have picked two stories to go with on this podcast that got just a little overstretched with federal agents, but most of them are just doing their job, and they do it by the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say all of them do, but in those two cases, it's been in my opinion, a little overreach. Two guys. All right. So, said in my mind, I want to always keep an open mind to hear both sides on what in any conversation. Now, Pilgreen wasn't a part of Ryan or Jeff Foyle's case, but we need a federal game warden on the podcast or next.
Oh, you do.
Warden. And he is the best.
We really do. Yeah, I agree.
So I made contact with a really good friend of mine, listened to this podcast. I knew he knew Pil Green real well, Christopher Logan. He's known Pil Green for a while. Like I said, man, how do I do it? How to get him on the show? Christopher said, look, the best way to do it is you need to call and talk to his son, get his son on your side, then do it. So I called his son up.
What's his son doing these days? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I called his son up last week, and I said, look, go through the accolades of our podcast and how well it's doing, how many people are listening to it. And for me, it is a dream to sit down and talk with Jim Pil Green. Absolute dream. There's nobody that I have more respect for in the waterfowling world when it comes to law enforcement than Mr. Pil Green. So I said, listen, I want for you to be on my side in this. I want you to meet with y'all, discuss, you know, because this is not a bash job on him. I just want him to get on here and talk about from the time he was, you know, just I want to do a whole story on him from the time he was born until he became a game warden and game warden stories. He's an interesting guy. He said, you got me. He said, I will go with you and be on your side and try to get him to do this. He said, there's one thing that I ask of you. I don't even know if I should be telling this, but I don't care. I said, sure, you name it, I'll do it. He said, when he gets done with recording all these with you, all I want is for you to pass me back the audio files of where you record it.
Sure.
Because we have been on Daddy about putting all these stories into a book.
Oh my gosh, what he saw, how the Delta changed, how people changed, how the birds changed, what the man saw, you know, would be so profound. And you know, not to mention the stories. And you know, I would like to hear someone like Jim. I'd like to hear Jim's stories. Boy, you better believe he's got some stories. I'd like to hear his thoughts as ex-law enforcement federal agent on the process. Why the case was made. What would he have seen? Why would he have taken that straight? You know, not to tip his hand or give an unfair advantage. I'm not talking about that. I just like to hear the other side of the story. You know what I'm saying? I just like to see, you know, you said the word overreach. Why? Why did they go with that? You know, and I know there's two sides to every story. I know that. I know there's two sides to every story, but you know, the two stories I've heard on End of the Line podcast make me break into a cold sweat. Somebody said on your forum, if they want you, they're going to get you. That's scary. That's scary, Rocky. Man, I grew up believing that I could chop down my daddy's favorite cherry tree and still be president. I grew up believing that the court system, you know, I believed I was innocent until proven guilty. You know, I thought the court system was, you know, and I don't mean a man going out, three men going out shooting 50 ducks. That's just ignorance and just sheer abuse of a law. I'm not talking about that. Nail their feet to a stake and put them in a fire ant bed. I mean, throw the book at them. Yeah, I get that. That's just childish. But, man, you know, I just can't imagine. agents going in and interviewing an 11-year-old child. I just can't imagine that. I can't imagine.
Here's the thing,
some of the stuff that went into those stores.
Here's the thing that I think that happens, and we've got to wrap this up, Ramsey. I think a lot of times in these federal cases, federal agents are led to believe in a lot of these cases there's a lot more there than they actually find when they get there. But they spent the time, they spent the resources trying to investigate this big thing. Well, you've got to justify it. Federal agents have to justify being there and spending so much money on a certain case that they're not going to let you off. They're going to find, any Lacey Act violation is a major law to be broken. Don't get me wrong. But a lot of times when you hear the backstory of the why of this stuff going on, the reason that they're there and the end convictions that come out they don't match up. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I guess not. I don't know. I don't, to me, there's got to be intent. I mean, no, it's like the,
I think you're going to find out either next week or 2 weeks from now on Ryan's podcast of he found out why they were there. And I think it's going to blow you away because the why and what they ended up convicting him for didn't match up. You know, Jeff shooting over the limit. Well, Jeff didn't, if you go back through there, Jeff wasn't shooting over the limit. A lot of people at his lodge, if we go out there and we group shoot and we come back and mistakes were made in Jeff's case where they would write ducks in people's names that weren't there.
Right.
I think there was one case of that. But
here's what I'm trying to say is I worked among in the same office building as Peel Green. And I was not law enforcement. Peel Green was the utmost professional. Everybody in law enforcement there in that office was the utmost professional. I wasn't privy to their stories, their case files, okay? They didn't drag me. I was a forester. So I wasn't involved in that. But, we're all in a small environment. You hear a few things here and there. You can't work in a small office and not just hear something. And when I worked with Mark Johnson, and I respected them both. I liked them both personally as people. I liked them as people, and I respected the work they did. And anybody that I was ever aware of that had been busted on any migratory bird violation deserved it.
I agree.
They were the utmost professionals, and it gave me a profound sense of respect for what those guys do. I mean, those federal agents aren't working 8-hour shifts. They are on the clock, around the clock, undercover, doing all kinds of stuff. I mean, they're gone from their families a lot. And, let's admit it, folks, so many topics we talk about, the absence of ducks. We want more ducks. We want an abundance of wildlife. We want all this good stuff. There are folks out there that will utterly abuse that resource.
Exactly what I was just fixing to say, Randy.
They'll abuse it. And we need, we're talking ducks. Man, some of the stuff I saw and became aware of as a forester and then briefly refuge manager working up there in North Mississippi, I mean, my Lord, man, snapping turtles. Those great big old snapping turtles, paddlefish. Man, there's stuff going on out there in this world that you just wouldn't even dream of, Rocky. I mean, we're talking about going out and shooting a few ducks, shooting 10 ducks too many, which is obscene in this day and age. But at the same time, man, we're talking, man, there's stuff going on out there. Folks, rape, pillaging, and plundering those great big old snapping turtles hoop netting and just raping the waterways for paddlefish just to get their freaking illegal caviar. I saw that stuff. You know, and it's these guys that are protecting that resource that can't protect itself. You know, and I'm telling you, man, we need them, but you know, I just like to hear, I'd love to hear, please tell Phil Green I said hello, because he's one of my favorite people up there. I love him to death. I love the time spent with him and the stories I heard. And his kids, and they were such good people. He was such a good person. I loved him to death, you know. And it's like, you know, when I hear them Pilgrim stories, I'll say this: I never heard anybody. All the Pilgrim stories I've ever heard, nobody denied having done wrong to it. You follow what I'm saying? It was all kind of told in context. We deserved it. You know, it made me love the man even more.
I'll say this. I'm going to end on this note. I encourage, listen, you've been listening to Jeff tell his side of the story on this podcast. One article that came to light to me by David Lindsay today, he sent me an article that was written in the International Game Wardens. He sent me a link to it, the International Game Wardens magazine. It was about Jeff, and, you know, they go at great length of the why they go into this. Now, on Jeff's side of it, Jeff's told that, you know, he did have a jilted spouse that he was getting a divorce from. It was a big deal. He had a partner that was trying to take his business that was messing around with his wife. Yeah. All right. So if you're the federal game wardens, and somebody calls you up and makes up stuff, hey, they're shooting over the limit, they're raping and pillaging ducks, you got to do, this guy makes up a story, this guy's getting drugged across the Canadian border. All right, if you're from sitting in the game warden's perspective, and you're seeing the videos that Jeff is putting out, kill them all, kill them, kill them, kill them, it doesn't take much for you to say, hey, let's go after this guy.
Of course not, no. That's your
job.
I mean, you know, these guys.
You
got to
admit, Ramsey, you got to admit, and if Jeff hears this, no disrespect to you, bud, back then, you weren't the greatest example in the world on videos.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing against you, but there was some disrespect shown to waterfowl in those videos. From a game warden's perspective. So it didn't take much to make them come after you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I can see, you know, one time I asked a collateral law enforcement, federal law enforcement officer, not a special agent, a collateral law enforcement. I didn't understand, for example, and I did not like this person. I will say that. I won't say his name, but I did not like him at all. He was miserable. He was a self-loathing person. This guy was not a special agent. He was just a collateral law enforcement, federal government. But he was by the book, no nonsense. And me, young and dumb, fresh out of grad school, working for the federal government, I just innocently asked this question one time. And I think it sums it up perfectly. But I asked him, I said, you know, I don't understand. Doves are migratory birds. Uh-huh, yeah. Ducks are migratory birds. Yep. Which are all under the purview, trust species of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, migratory birds. Right, doves, blackbirds, warblers, waterfowl, migratory birds, crows, migratory birds, it all falls under the purview, cormorants, all falls under the purview, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Trust species. And I'm talking about ducks and doves. And I said, but I don't understand. I can go out there and plant sunflowers or corn and bush hog it. Shred it, spread it, and shoot doves, but I can't do it for ducks. And I was just innocently trying to make a distinction. And what this collateral law enforcement said, it was very, it was surly the way he said it, but it was on point. And the way I'll communicate is, it doesn't matter. The law is the law. As law enforcement, my job is to enforce the law, not to interpret it. If you want an interpretation, go ask a judge, go ask Congress. I'm here to enforce.
Right.
And that's what you really got to remember, folks. The laws are there. And, you know, we're blessed in America. We are truly blessed in America with black and white law. Now, I'm not saying there's some gray area subject to interpretation, because I was sitting there reading parts of Part 20 of, you know, migratory bird laws, you know. And, you know, you got to read careful. It would help me to be a attorney to read those things. They were written by attorney types, you know, and it's not just, you know, don't do over 65, but it's pretty plainly written. And it's not just that we have the laws black and white. The law is black and white, but it's the way that you might not read the Federal Register every day. But all those laws, every change, all this stuff is put out in Federal Register, and then it's put out in sporting goods outlets. You know, it's put out in pamphlets. It's put out on the internet. It's very rapid distribution in terms of this knowledge. And so, you know, if they quit shooting pintails this year, we'll all know it. Unless you're living under a rock, you'll know going into the season what the limits are, what the shooting times are, what the laws are. It's all painted out, and all we got to do is color in between the lines. It's all painted out. You go to some countries, it might take years for that information become fully disseminated, if ever, let alone see public. I mean I'm telling you, you know, there's even though the mother countries might have internet, might have, you know, they don't disseminate and get the information out like we in America do. You know, so those laws are out there. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's just your responsibility, my responsibility as a hunter.
Understand them.
To understand them. And, you know, really and truly, I don't know if you've ever applied to say, go hunt something big game wise out in Montana. Whew, buddy, you want to talk about some laws and some rules, and you better pour yourself a tall drink and light a big long cigar before you start getting buried up in that stuff and reading. It gets real complicated and convoluted, and as compared to just picking up the federal, you know, reading the laws on duck limits and what to shoot and what to do and tag your birds when you come out, you know. And that's just how it is, you know. But we've got to, you know, you can hate and be disrespectful and whatever else about federal law enforcement. But at the end of the day, you just got to look at yourself and say, they're law enforcement. They're law enforcement. No different than a highway patrol or anybody else. They're law enforcement, and they're not trying to interpret the law. They're just enforcing what they know of the law. And I will say, you know, and that's just my take on it with my dealings, especially with Phil Green and Mark Johnson. They were good people. They were good people, and they were good law enforcement.
Well,
and, I can say the same thing about my old buddy Rob Heffern from the state side. I just, you know, he took the time to make a teachable moment with Forrest, and he was straight arrow, as far as I'm concerned. I enjoyed being around him.
Well, I will let you know tomorrow. After I meet with him, it's going to happen or not. You find out on Duck South. But
tell him
you need to go eat your tomato sandwich, and we need to go, Ramsey. Thank you again for another great Thursday. I've really enjoyed it. I want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.